Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here back on the program Jim Kaler. He's an emeritus professor of astronomy at the U of I, and occasionally is here, and we talk a little bit about astronomy, which you can see in the sky various times of the year. And if you have questions, you can pick up the telephone and call in. I know he will do his best to give you an answer. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois or Indiana. Actually, even if you were listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that number too. That's 800-222-9455.
You mean all those Canadians can't hear you?
No, they can hear, but only in the continental United States can use the toll-free line.
Oh, okay.
They can call from Canada, but they got to pay for the call.
Okay.
That's right. Any place that you're listening, yeah, you could call in, but you'd have to pay the freight on the call. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. You want to talk a little bit about what's up there in the sky, right?
Sure. So, well, Venus, of course, tops the list.
I get
a call every couple of days. What is that big, bright thing up there? And it's going to get a little bit brighter. It's getting a little bit lower, but for the next couple of weeks or so, it'll continue to get brighter. And it's just getting closer to the Earth, that's all, on its latest sweep around us. And it's bright enough to cast a shadow if you're out in the country. I mean the real country, away from all city lights. And after twilight is over, if you're out in the woods, you can see the trees casting eerie shadows on the ground under Venus light. It's really quite a fascinating sight. And you can see it in broad daylight. It's tough to find, but it's up there. It's a little pinpoint of bright light. You look at it and say, how can I possibly have missed that? And you look away and it's gone. Might fool you into thinking it's a high-flying airplane, except that it just sits there.
Yeah.
And if you look to the next brightest thing to the east of it, you can see Saturn, which is considerably brighter. Venus is over 100 times brighter than Saturn right now. And the two are going to come into a very close conjunction before too terribly long, just after the beginning of July, when they'll pass each other and make for a very nice sight July 1st, actually, the beginning of the month. They'll be only about an angular diameter of the moon apart, give or take a little bit. And Venus, of course, the bright one. And what else we got? We got Jupiter. You look over in the southeast just after dark, and you can see Jupiter climbing the sky. It's the second brightest thing in the sky. And in the morning, 4 a.m., you take a look, you might be able to spot reddish Mars, which is nowhere near as bright as it's the other two. So that's sort of what's up in there right now. We have, of course, the usual summertime meteors coming along. That'll be in August 12th or 13th or so. And it's very nice this year, since there will be no moon to light the sky, and we can see bunches of meteors. If you're out in the country, again, if you're going to try it from town, you'll just see the very brightest ones. You need to get out into the dark.
I have been enjoying seeing Venus there. It's really beautiful, and it's unmistakable once you know what it is. I'm thinking that in the past, maybe I wasn't paying attention, or I didn't realize what it was or where it was. Are we in a particular time where Venus is, because of the orbits, it's just
this is
close?
One of the best apparitions we've had in several years. Mm-hmm. It's all cyclic. Venus goes through an 8-year cycle. That's probably a coincidence, and 8 years from now, you'll see very much the same thing that you're seeing today. The summertime is very nice if Venus is in the right position, because of the high tilt of the zodiac and the ecliptic. So it gets very high in the sky and sets very late. It'll be disappearing by around the end of July, early August, and then it'll pop up in the morning sky, and we'll have a very nice viewing of it in late fall and early winter.
Mm-hmm. I seem to remember a time maybe about 2 years ago when it was very big and very bright in the fall, and I was seeing it at about the time I was going home, and as I recall, it was after the time change, so it was about 5 o'clock.
The last
it was
time
dark.
Was in the more or less in the winter time, and it didn't get as high. It gets as bright, it just doesn't get quite as high. So it has a 500 and some day period relative to the Earth, and a year and a half or so, and you'll see it again year and a half from now. Just look much like it does today, except in a different part of the sky. Mm-hmm. But it's unmistakable because of its brightness. Even at its faintest, it's overwhelmingly brighter than anything else in the sky other than the sun and the moon.
Yeah, it's going to be when you get to twilight, it's really going to be the first thing that you're going to see.
If you've got a telescope, it presents a really interesting sight. You can't see anything on the ground because it's covered with clouds, but it goes through phases because you're just seeing. Right now, it's swinging between the Earth and the Sun, and you're looking mostly at the nighttime side facing us, and you just see a sliver of daylight. So it's going into its crescent phase right now, and as it does so, it gets closer to the Earth. The crescent gets thinner and thinner, and bigger and bigger and bigger. And there are reports of people, especially kids with really good eyesight, being able to see the crescent with the naked eye, although that's sort of problematic. But even a small telescope will show it up fairly quickly.
We have a caller. Let's talk with them. Someone up in the northern part of the state in Sycamore. It's line number 4, the toll-free line, right here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
I have a question about the figure eight pattern the sun makes in the sky when you do a time-lapse photography of the sun in the same at the same time every day.
Right.
Set a camera on a tripod, and if you've got it protected and so forth, and snap a photograph at the same instant every day of the year, the sun will make a peculiar little figure eight pattern in the sky, and I can see why it might, why it makes a line. I could see why the line is tilted because of the Earth, because of whatever latitude you're at. And it moves around because the Earth's tilted on its axis, and it goes around the sun.
Right.
And I can also see that it might not be a line, but an oval or a narrow pattern because the Earth is moving at different speeds in its orbit because it's not a perfect circle.
It's called the analemma.
But I can't see why
and
it would make a figure eight.
You can see it on older globes. If you remember as a school kid, you had an old globe in the library, and there was this odd figure eight pattern sitting out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's exactly the same thing. First picture of the analemma was taken by Dennis DiCicco, Sky and Telescope, and he positioned his camera, took a year picture, and then discovered he had the camera wrong, and the bottom part of the sun didn't clear the house, so he had to throw that away and start it all over again. It took him 2 years to make the picture, which is probably a record. Other people have replicated it since. The reason for the figure eight pattern, it's going north and south, of course, because of the tilt of the Earth's axis. You're right. That's just the same as the basic cause of the seasons. But the sun doesn't have a constant motion along the ecliptic, in part because of the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit. When we're farthest from the sun appears to move slower to the east relative to the stars, which is about now, aphelion, when we're farthest, and the sun comes up on July 5th or 6th this year. And in the wintertime, the sun moves faster. This is the same reason that winter is actually a few days shorter than summer, because the sun sort of hurries through its pattern. The other part of it is that the tilt plays a role, too. Time of day is told by the projection, if this makes any sense, the projection of the sun from the pole down onto the equator. But the sun isn't moving on the equator, it's moving on this tilted ecliptic. So you put that together with the eccentricity, and our time of day, of course, has to be constant. So it's the average position of the sun. So the sun gets a little ahead of its average position, a little bit behind its average position. And when you take a picture at the same clock time, mean time, the average time, not sundial time, but the clock time, then the sun will get a little bit ahead and a little bit behind, and hence you get this figure eight pattern. It's the same reason why the earliest sunset occurs around December 7th, not at the time of the solstice, because the sun is west of its mean position that time, and it's sort of an extreme. And by the time of the solstice, the sun is actually setting significantly later in the day. Take a look next winter.
Well,
same
so
thing.
It's not just because of eccentricity.
It's also the tilt of the Earth's axis plays a role. It plays about an equal role in it, too, because you're not telling sun. If you did it in sundial time, you wouldn't see the same effect. You'd see a figure eight, but it'd be much narrower. You're doing it in what's called Greenwich mean time or basic mean time, which is averaging out the projection of the sun down on the equator.
Well, very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right.
Bye
thanks
now.
For the call. Let's go on here to talk with someone else. And this is someone in Champaign, and it's line one.
Good yeah, morning, right. Professor mm-hmm. Kaler.
Good morning.
I'm always glad to hear you on the radio.
Thank you.
The other night, I don't know if this week was particularly good, but there was the observation for those of us who knew about it of the space shuttle and the International Space Station.
Yeah, as usual, I missed it.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I just want to encourage people who are interested in stargazing, which is a great thing, to just get out and look at the night sky and let them know. You can usually see, if you take 15 minutes, you're guaranteed to see at least one satellite.
They're very common. It's just dirty with satellites there. You can tell them because they don't have strobe lights on them. Airplanes will have strobe lights and satellites that just glimmer. And then they hit the twilight and they dim out and they just go dark when they go into the shadow of the Earth.
But as someone who waits for meteors, I think sometimes it's kind of exciting to actually count how many satellites you can
see. It's really quite remarkable. And you may be startled every once in a while to see an iridium flare, this part of the iridium system that Motorola unsuccessfully launched for cell phone use. And they are designed to catch glints of sunlight. And they can be overwhelmingly bright, brighter than Venus. And they'll just go zapping you on the ground. It's just quite amazing to see one. Keep your eyes out, but it's not a UFO. It's just a satellite. Some of them do flare, and they have reflective surfaces, and they can vary in their brightness. One of the curious things about looking at satellites going overhead is that they seem to wander back and forth and kind of a zigzag pattern, and that's a fairly well-known optical illusion. It's the eye that's zigging back and forth and not the satellite.
Sure.
You might take a look for that. And I've had a number of calls about these things that are wandering around in the sky, and they're not. They're going in a straight line.
Yeah, and just so people who are interested, you should use the web. My computer's without power because I'm rewiring right now. But you can find out the space station schedule for your area.
Yep.
And the other night, I'm sure a lot of people would have thought they saw a UFO because it was as bright as Jupiter. It was just amazing. And so I want to encourage people to get out and look for it, and thanks a lot.
Oh, you're very welcome. UFOs are just things that people don't know what they are. It's not space aliens, because then you identify them as something. I mean, there's lots of sites up there that are not, they're relatively rare, and then there are some things that still aren't understood in nature, or the descriptions are bad, one thing after the other. Venus is everybody's favorite UFO because it follows you along. If you drive along a country road, it follows you.
As you say, it
seems to follow you.
It's so bright that you can't miss it. It's next to the sun, right? Next to the moon, it's going to be the brightest thing.
Yeah, and
in
it
the
can
sky.
Be eerie. If you get a day with high haze or clouds, it's even visible through light clouds, and it will be a big puffy. I've seen it as sort of a eerie, sort of puffy ball. It won't look anything like a planet at all.
So do you know, I guess we should have asked the caller, approximately what time we were talking about to see the
I can't remember. I think it was in early twilight.
Okay.
That's pretty much what
So you don't have to set your alarm to get up in the middle of the night or anything?
Well, it depends on when it's coming over. If the gentleman's right, all that information is available on the web. You can Google it and find out when it will be visible in certain parts of the country.
All right. Jim Kaler's our guest. He's astronomer here at the U of I, professor emeritus of astronomy, and every once in a while he's here and we talk about what you can see in the sky. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You want to talk maybe a little bit more about Venus? Just what do we know about
Venus? It's a nasty place, at least as far as humans are concerned. Of course, that's a human judgment.
If
you were Venusian, you'd probably
think
it was just great. No,
exactly.
There aren't any. Believe me, there aren't any. The temperature's around 900 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface. It's a greenhouse effect gone mad. All the carbon in Venus, instead of being in the crust, is in the atmosphere in the form of CO2, or at least most of it. Whereas in the Earth, much of it's in the crust. And we have very, very low CO2 content in the Earth's atmosphere. Venus, it's 100 atmospheric pressures, 96 of which are CO2. You couldn't survive on the planet just as a result of the pressure and the huge temperature. So all we see from Earth is the up top of the cloud deck, which is about 50 kilometers above the surface of the planet. And the clouds have some structure. It's seen from the ground, but just like Earth's atmosphere has, structural patterns in it, various wind patterns, so does Venus's. The surface rocks are relatively soft. That has resulted in a tremendous volcanism. Mm-hmm. There are just hundreds of shield-type, Hawaiian-type volcanoes all over the surface. Whether they're active or not is not really known. Probably they are, or at least one of them, on occasion. There's very strong evidence that the planet underwent a complete volcanic turnover, complete repaving of half a billion or so years ago because of the number of impact craters that you see on the surface, which is relatively low compared to, say, the moon. It's only accumulated a few. And you can, given the rate on the moon, you can sort of use that as an estimate for how the age of a surface of a planet, be it Mars or Venus or even some of the satellites of the outer solar system.
Mm. Is the big determining factor about conditions on Venus its proximity to the sun?
Probably. It produced a runaway greenhouse effect. The basic idea is that the high temperatures prevented water, which prevent the incorporation of carbon into the rocks, and it stays in the atmosphere, and it bakes out sulfur as well. So, and the rocks are soft, and that promotes volcanism that produces more CO2 in the atmosphere. And combination of the sulfur and the oxygen that's produced by breakdown from sunlight produce the clouds, which are made out of sulfuric acid, not water. And apparently there's parts in the clouds where it sort of rains sulfuric acid, although it never hits the ground because it's too dang hot. Mm. It's truly, from a human perspective, it's just an awful, awful place. I don't think it's any place that any sane astronaut would ever want to go. Mm.
Is it the case that a lot of what we know about Venus is from Russia?
Didn't they sort of specialize in it. Yeah, yeah, they landed a couple of, maybe four packages on the surface that actually took images of just this sea of flat rock going out to the horizon. But most of what we know about Venus comes from radar, and the vast majority from the Magellan spacecraft, which was in orbit around Venus for a few years, and produce maps, surface maps of practically the whole planet. Now the Europeans have a satellite in orbit doing much the same thing at higher resolution. Radar from Earth, you can hit the thing with radar signals from Earth. And that was the first indication we had of Venus's rotation, which is weird. It's backwards. It's 247-day backward rotation, 243, one or the other, backward rotation period. So it's unlike Earth, which rotates counterclockwise. Venus rotates clockwise, seen down from the north. Mm. So does Pluto, and so does sort of Uranus. The other planets all sort of rotating in synchrony. So it's a very strange place.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jim Kaler. He's a professor emeritus of astronomy here at
UofI. Of course, you could say that the Earth is a very strange planet. I had to interrupt that, too, because it's got you and me talking about planets and other people listening about them, and no other planet can make that statement.
As far as we know.
So far as we know, that's correct. But we can certainly be sure that there are no radio studios on Mars. That we have nailed down.
Okay. Well, among that, the various things we can say about Mars, there is no public radio on Mars.
How sad.
Well, there is here on the Earth, though. And so if you have questions, whether you're from here or someplace else, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Recently there have been a couple of stories about Mars, and I'm not sure if this is really, really new, but I think that these stories were saying that we have more and more reason, apparently, to believe that there was liquid water
a lot of evidence. Yeah, there even were images from spacecraft of what appeared to be fresh water runs and gullies on the sides of craters. So apparently it still erupts once in a while. There's no liquid water on the surface. It can't permanent. You can get it for a little while, but it can't stay there because the atmospheric pressure is too low. It's less than 1% of that Earth's. So carbon dioxide on Earth, which evaporates instantly, so does water on Mars, although you can get water ice, and you can get it in the solid form, and there's quite a bit of it mixed into the carbon dioxide, the dry ice up at the poles, and probably a lot of it is permafrost in the ground. That's where how deep it goes and where it is not sure. It seems to occupy a good fraction of the northern hemisphere, where craters are kind of soft. Like mud flows, and spacecraft with neutron spectrometers have shown very clear evidence that there's subterranean water. submarsh-marsharanian, or whatever you want to call it, water. So there's good indication that there was could have been a warm water ocean at some point, but it would have been billions of years ago.
A long time ago. And no, we don't have any good theories about what happened to change that?
It's the planet's just too small. It's much less massive than the Earth, and it can't retain an atmosphere. So the atmosphere breaks down. Even the water breaks down to some degree under sunlight. And even if you could somehow magically pump up the atmosphere, its mass isn't great enough to hold one for any significant period, astronomically significant period of time. The Earth does. The Earth and Venus both have relatively high mass, and they can even Venus, with its proximity to the sun, is able to retain the atmosphere with no trouble at all. Mercury, again, has virtually nothing because of its proximity to the sun, and it's very, very low mass, only a few percent that of the Earth. Hmm.
So that just makes me think about this. There is some kind of delicate balance of factors
called the Goldilocks effect.
It has to be just right.
That's right. Venus is a little too hot, Mars is a little too cold, and the Earth is just right. There's a ring of around the sun in which a planet the size of the Earth can retain liquid water. And that seems, in our parochial view, probably necessary for life, although, heck, who knows? You know, every time we've sort of guessed from our limited perspective on Earth, we've pretty much been shown to be wrong. So we have no idea about life forms elsewhere, none whatsoever.
Mm. Does that mean that there is an optimum size you can get? There can be a planet that seems to be too small to support life.
These low mass stars, yeah, like so-called red dwarfs, like Proxima Centauri, it's the nearest star to the Earth. The water ring, so to speak, the life-giving zone from our perspective would be much smaller because the star is only a few percent the luminosity of the sun. And you'd have to be tucked up right close to it to get enough heat. And there's been a lot in the press about this. I can't remember the Gliese whatever. I can't remember the name of the star. This star that is a super Earth of six or so terrestrial masses, which is probably a misnomer. And it seemed for a time, that's been debunked, but it seemed for a time to be in the life-giving zone. And, there was great excitement about it without realizing that nobody spoke of the fact that many of these red dwarfs are flare stars, as is Proxima Centauri, and they produce magnetic flares as suddenly the star gets twice as bright as it was before. And that is not healthy to life.
That would be a problem.
So I don't think I'd want to be in orbit around as many as there are. There are more of these low-mass stars than any other kind, but they seem to be a pretty poor place for life, given that a good fraction of maybe half of them are flare stars and the other half have the potential for it.
Well, what kind of list now do we have of places where we would think that there would be at least a good possibility that we'd have.
It depends on how optimistic or pessimistic you are. I suppose on Earth we've got Mars, which is still a possibility. Mm-hmm. You drill down, you don't know what you're going to find. The experiments that have been done have not been definitive. And then you start talking about places like Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, which clearly, far as you can tell anyway, a deep water, warm ocean underneath an icy crust. And people say, hey, warm ocean, life. Well, I don't know. You're going to have to drill down and find out. You talk about an expensive experiment. You're not going to see that one for a while. And I suppose you could say almost any star that's vaguely similar to the sun, the ones that live long enough to have allowed life to significantly develop. And there's an awful lot of them. The thing is, we're not capable of detecting Earth-sized planets yet. There are about 220, 230 known planets in orbit around other stars, but they're all Jupiter size, except for a little tail that go down to several Earths, but nothing of the order of what we find in our planetary system. And one of the amazing things we found is, again, we expected all other planetary systems to be like our own, and they all seem to be different from ours. it's the Copernican effect going wild. You know, we used to think the Earth was at the center of things, and now nothing is at the center of things. Not only that, there isn't any center anywhere, and none of these solar systems that we're seeing out there seem to resemble the Earth, partly because we haven't been looking long enough. It takes a long time to do a complete inventory, and the technology isn't entirely up to it yet, although it's been proven to be pretty amazing. I think it's one of the most amazing developments of my astronomical life has been watching the discovery of yet more and more and more planets.
And we just haven't been able to do that because the telescopes aren't powerful.
Nobody's
enough?
Actually ever seen one. We've seen some of the imaged one. We have seen infrared radiation or detected infrared radiation with heat-sensitive telescopes. But nobody's ever actually imaged a planet. They're just too faint. I mean, look at Venus, the brightest planet, compare it to the sun. You put Venus in proximity to the sun, you're not going to see Venus. It's just not bright enough. You get overwhelming. If you were on Alpha Centauri, for example, with the best of our equipment looking back at the Earth, you know, the closest star to the Earth, the closest star system, you couldn't see Jupiter. The sun would be just so overwhelmingly bright that Jupiter would be lost in the glare. Right. So we can't really see them yet. The technology will probably allow, the way things are going, wouldn't surprise me after 10 or 20 years or maybe even less to begin to get the first images, but we're not there yet.
Right. Let's talk with another caller here. Someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm coming in late on the conversation, but I would like to know, and I'm sure you probably covered it, what planets are visible in the summer sky? I proudly pointed out Venus at dusk to a couple of my grandkids. I think they thought I was an expert in astronomy. But
yeah,
I listened to your show, and it was the brightest thing in the sky. And I said, look, guys, there is Venus.
If you look from east to west in the early evening, the first thing you see is Venus. And then you look a few degrees, not very far to the east from Venus, you'll see Saturn. And that's the next brightest thing. And then a little bit farther over, not very far, is a star called Regulus. So you've got Venus, Saturn, and Regulus, which is a first magnitude star. And you look way over into the east and you'll see Jupiter in the southeast. Okay. That's quite bright. You can't miss it. That's by far the brightest thing in the southeast. And if you're willing to wait till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you might be able to spot the rising of Mars.
All right. Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. And others are welcome here as we talk with Jim Kaler. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Jim is an emeritus professor of astronomy here at the U of I, author of a number of books about astronomy. Go down to the bookstore. Look for them if you're interested in astronomy and stars.
Available at Barnes & Noble and at Amazon.
Popularly priced, suitable for gift giving. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I was going to ask you about the poor Pluto.
Oh, dear.
Pluto's been downgraded. Of course, we know that for a while. And apparently now the body that is a little further out, which has now been given a name, Eris.
Eris.
Now apparently...
Goddess of Discord, which makes...
Is that really what...
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Goddess of Discord. Poor Pluto, not only is it not a planet anymore, but now they apparently have decided that Eris is... Is it bigger or heavier?
It's bigger and slightly more massive, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's much farther away and much dimmer. So Pluto is the nearest of these... The nearest of the large so-called Kuiper Belt objects. So does it deserve planetary status? It's a sort of a failed planet. It just didn't make it as – so it depends on where you put your cutoff. And I guess if you want Pluto to be a planet, then Eris should be a planet, except Eris is much farther away and you can't see it very well anyway. So why not keep Pluto a planet and the heck with it? That's my point of view.
So
it's not a popular point of view, maybe, but
I think these
categorizations get a little out of hand sometimes.
People are still – Are still arguing? Aren't they still unhappy about Pluto being booted out of the solar system?
I'm going down to Nioga tomorrow to talk to a bunch of grade school kids in a library program, which we do occasionally. And when I've done this, I do a popularity. Usually, part of the shtick is to do a popularity poll, and they love Pluto. Venus probably and Pluto. The other planets, maybe, but Pluto is just overwhelmingly popular. It's the sort of body that maybe it's a Disney dog, I don't know, but it's a mysterious kind of body known since 1930. And kids seem to fall in love with the concept of maybe it's the mystery of it. Mm. But it's it was one of the reasons I kind of like to keep Pluto as an honorary planet, if nothing else. And you can't change it. You can change what people call it, but Pluto is still Pluto.
Yeah.
It's the first body, however you want to define it, it's the first body of the Kuiper Belt, which is this belt of debris outside the orbit of Neptune. Discovered first, one of the largest.
So why is it that it took us a while to actually see Eris?
It's just so faint.
Because it's just so far away.
It's very dim and very far away, and it's required very sophisticated telescopes and imaging systems to be able to see them. The first of the Kuiper Belt was actually hypothesized because of short-period comets coming into the sun. A lot of these bodies seem to be icy and kind of get close to the sun and they produce comets. And the short-period comets sort of stick to the plane of the solar system. So they had to be coming from some reservoir out beyond Neptune. So it got a name even before anything was discovered in it. Then in the 90s, we began with some of the large telescopes, much larger than Palomar, and the electronic detection systems that were developing began to pick up other ones out there. And now there's over 1,000 of them known. It's just this immense belt of debris that goes out 50, 60 times farther from the sun than Earth, whereas Pluto averages about 40. We've always known Pluto as a wacky object. Something was curious and peculiar about it. It's got a very eccentric orbit. It goes very far from the average plane of the solar system. It's very tilted, and it just doesn't conform to the other planets. I mean, we've known that since Tombaugh discovered it back in 1930. And it's typical of the Kuiper Belt objects that have all these nutty orbits. They're not particularly circular, neither does Eris, for that matter. It's a belt of stuff that probably was just too thin to have accumulated through collision into a planet like Neptune. And instead, Neptune stirred them up and they just whack themselves apart now in collisions. Pluto is curious in that it's also trapped by Neptune. It comes inside the orbit of Neptune for a period of about 20 years in its 230-year orbit. And Neptune actually has it trapped. Pluto goes around, on the average, if you average it out over a million years, Pluto goes around the sun twice for every time Neptune goes around three times. And it's exact.
Hmm.
It's called a gravitational resonance. So Pluto's been caught by Neptune, and a whole bunch of the other objects are in the same situation.
So do we think that out in the Kuiper Belt there could be stuff even bigger than Eris, and it's just far away for us to see?
Quite likely. We don't know how far away they tend to scatter and what other bodies. We're still establishing a census of the solar system. They haven't tracked down all the asteroids yet. Depends on how far you go. You can't track down something that's only an inch across. It's still an asteroid. You know, where do you draw the line? But at least we seem to have most of the basic ideas of how the solar system is constructed. There's more to it than that. There's this huge cloud of debris around the sun called the Oort cloud, which is another reservoir of cometary bodies that could extend halfway the nearest star. Hmm. It's a complicated place we live in.
Well, if you have questions about this complicated place we live in, you can give us a call. Jim Kaler is our guest. He's a professor emeritus of astronomy here at U of I. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We've about 15 minutes or so left in this first hour of Focus 580. I'm interested in the idea that people should be so attached to Pluto. You can't. It's not one of the naked eye planets, so you can't
see it. No, it's about 10,000 times fainter than anything you can see with the naked eye. I've never seen it in a telescope. I mean, I've had the opportunity, but I've never taken the telescope time to look for it. It has been seen. You know, it's been seen in the quad telescope in the darker days before the university illuminated the campus as bright as the sun. But it's a tough thing to see, tough thing to find. It was an amazing discovery of the time. It took 2 years before it was tracked down by Tombaugh. And it's probably mystery, you know. You've got five planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, six. Well, five that you can see in the sky that have no discoverers. They've been known since ancient times, were part of astrology and all this before people understood what they actually were. And then the Uranus was discovered in the 19th century, which is visible to the naked eye, if you know where to look for it. Neptune, through mathematical calculation by its disturbances on Uranus, which was an amazing discovery in the middle of the 19th century. And then Pluto as a mysterious last body of the solar system that we at least thought was the last body. And that probably accounts for its popularity, so to speak, as the mystery planet about which almost nothing was known until really Hubble was able to resolve it into a disk. And we finally got a size of it. And before that, it was discovered to have a satellite and we get its mass. And now we know at least a little bit about it. It seems to be very similar to Neptune's largest moon, Triton, which goes around Neptune backwards and is obviously a captured body and is almost identical to Pluto. So that gives you two of them that are very similar to each other. It's just an immense amount of stuff out there.
What we talked about Venus being very bright and it's very beautiful. So it's the kind of thing that's going to get your attention.
Oh, yeah.
The other naked eye planets, maybe there are times when they are going to be brighter than a lot of the stars.
Jupiter is always brighter than the brightest of the stars. It doesn't vary much. It's because it's far away from us, so it doesn't vary very much. Its distance isn't very much from the Earth over the years. And that's pretty obvious. If you look in the southeast in the early part of the evening, more to the south, really, it's just glows. You can't – it's pretty low right now. It's entering – it's sort of bottoming out in its orbit between Scorpius and Sagittarius. And it's just a beautiful sight. And if you got binoculars, even binoculars put on Jupiter, you can see its four satellites. You know, watch them over the days, go take a few days, couple of weeks, go around the planet. Doesn't take much telescopic power to see them. Heck, you know, Galileo, who had a terrible first telescope. It's worse than anything you could buy at any local store, and spotted them right away. Mm. Any small instrument will pick them up.
So I guess I'm thinking of the time, even before there were telescopes, if you had a really good dark sky, that the planets would stand out as being something
special.
Yeah,
not only that, they move. And they move obviously relative to the background stars. Jupiter is now in sort of in between Scorpius and Sagittarius. Next year it'll be over in Sagittarius. The following year it'll be Capricornus because it takes 12 years to go around us. Hence, it's probably why it's called was named Jupiter. It's just a very slow, stately progression through the background constellations. And Saturn takes twice as long. Mars goes zipping around. You can see Mars's motion against the background if you know your stars. Even if you don't know them, you know, make up a pattern of some sort and look at Mars, and you can see it zipping along within a course of only a couple of days. I remember seeing Mars close to a star through a large telescope, and you could actually, if you look carefully, it's like watching the minute hand of a clock. You could actually see it move
really
against the background. And you know, nobody knew what they were, so they move, and you know the gods are up there in the sky. So maybe these planets are gods, and maybe if we can figure out what they're doing up there, we can learn what our fates are going to be. Astrology rose out of that. Astronomy and astrology were pretty closely linked until Copernican times, when Copernicus sort of figured out what was actually going on, that there were all bodies in orbit around the sun, and the break sort of began then.
So that I guess that's what that was the answer to my question, that the planets and the way they behave, the way they look, is sufficiently different from stars so that you would think
it just jumps right out.
That's something.
Yeah.
Something different.
You have to realize that the ancients, of course, had dark skies. There were no artificial lights to speak of, and they could note these planets' movements very, very easily. Anybody who looked up could see it. The word planet comes out of Greek, meaning a wandering body. And it's not subtle.
We have time left for other questions. Again, I just want to tell people listening, you've got a question, you want to call in, talk with our guest, Jim Kaler.
Everybody's at the beach.
I guess. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, one of the things that I was going to ask you about was Tunguska. I came across an article in one of the magazines, I think it was Sky and Telescope maybe, that they think – I guess for some time the belief was that this blasted place in Siberia, this was the result of a meteor,
A small asteroid probably
that entered the atmosphere and then
blew up. It blew up in the air. The fragile there's from my recollection, there's embedded meteorite particles in the trees. It exploded. And if you ever see a bright meteor, sometimes you can watch them explode in the air and just sort of disappear. It looks like a celestial firework. And this thing just devastated miles around. There's no crater because it blew up and it didn't ever hit the ground. But it leveled trees for miles around it. There were apparently Russian farmers who were Siberian farmers who were 20, 30 miles away who were knocked down by the shockwave. It was a tremendous series of blasts that were pretty well recorded by the people there at the time. And there's still you can see tree from the photographs I've seen. You see tree trunks lying radially outward from the point of the blast.
Mm-hmm.
How big was it? Maybe the size of a barn house, something like that. It was pretty big. It was the biggest blast of the 20th century in terms of asteroid impacts. And although there was a pretty good sized one, apparently, again, in Siberia is not a target. It just happens to be big, that's all, I think in 1947. It happens occasionally. We had a wonderful, I guess you'd call it wonderful, since it didn't hit, a near miss in the 1970s when a large house-size meteor was seen all the way from New Mexico up through British Columbia, just zipping along, and the atmosphere, hit the atmosphere, became very bright, and then just left, never landed.
Fortunately,
yeah. So they, you know, if you're ever out in northern Arizona, if you want to see the what can happen with an asteroid impact and see Meteor Crater, which was a result of an iron asteroid about the size of a house hitting the Earth. So these things happen occasionally. Right. There are somewhere around 200 recognized impact craters on the Earth, including one underlies O'Hare Field in Chicago.
Really?
You can't see it. It's completely covered over, but there's good evidence for a shock for fractured rock deep down. I think it's called the Desplaines structure.
Well, we have some. The only reason I mention that is because apparently there is an Italian geologist who thinks he's found the impact crater, and it's a lake. That's
that's interesting.
A few miles near the few miles northwest of the suspected epicenter. It's called Lake Checo. That he thinks that is the impact.
Yeah, I can't comment on that.
I guess there's some they can determine that by taking a look at what the structure of the bottom of the lake is. Apparently, something about the shape will tell you whether it is.
Impact craters have specific shapes to them, but then they get filled in, and you can tell through gravity measurements and through, you know, geological drilling and the like.
Yeah.
And that's how they've identified the Chicxulub crater, which was 65 million years old, probably was the impact that took out the dinosaurs. You can't see anything from the air, but there's Pemex, the Mexican oil company, found it through drilling.
Mm.
And then you can take gravity measurement. You can image the crater in various ways, although you can't really see it directly. Huge thing, a couple hundred miles across.
Well, let's talk with some more folks here. In the time that we have left, we'll talk with someone in Mawikwa first here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Wondered if your guest could give us any information on the Hubble repair mission and also what type of instrument is going to be replacing Hubble.
As far as I know, the repair mission is on track. They have to replace positional gyroscopes, I think batteries, and one of the imaging systems has died. It's a very harsh environment, and it's remarkable how the Hubble has kept going for such a long time. The replacement, although it won't be a direct replacement, it's a different kind of instrument, will be a much larger telescope in a much, much higher orbit. And for the life of me at the moment, I can't remember the name of it. It's a long time ago. For a long time, it was called the Next Generation Space Telescope. It's got a name at this point. And it'll be at a stable gravitational position, but much farther from the Earth. It'll sort of track the Earth around the sun, and it won't be accessible through the shuttle. The shuttle can't go that far away. So it's a one-shot affair. It gets out there, it has a lifetime, and it dies. It's basically an infrared telescope, and it's designed largely to look at very distant galaxies, although it'll probably be useful for a lot of other things as well. But it won't be a general purpose, same kind of general purpose instrument the Hubble is.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
The James E. Webb Telescope. It just came to me.
No, that was named after the guy who headed NASA.
Yeah, it was named after NASA administrator.
All right. Let's go to line number two. This is Champagne. Hello. So call there, line two in Champagne.
Hello. Just real quick.
Yeah.
I just was able to tune in now. Is it possible to see the space station with the naked eye? And if not, how could we see it in the night sky?
Yeah, you can see it. It's bright enough that gets a lot of reflects a lot of sunlight. It's got an erratic movement relative to any specific place on Earth. You have to catch it at the right time. And I can't give you a schedule, but there are schedules on the web. If you Google the space station, you can get a schedule for when it will be visible at any specific point and what time.
Okay, and we have somebody else here. This is Urbana, and the caller would be line number three right here. Hello.
Two questions for you. One is, are the Hubble images that we see in publications for folks like us, are they color enhanced? That's one question. And my second question is politics. You know, we've got the biologists have a problem with religious fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, being sure that Earth was only created 6,000 years ago and evolution is not a fact but a hypothesis. All that the astronomers are coming up with, including astronomy involving Earth features, indicates that we're billions of years older than, things are billions of years older.
Well,
I'm just wondering if that's affecting the science or the funding.
Okay, the first question, the raw Hubble images are always in black and white, and it's like Technicolor. You take them through different filters, and then you combine the images into a color picture. The filters are not classic primary colors, so it's difficult to get an exact replication of what you would see were your eyes sensitive enough to see it in color. But it can come pretty close, and they do their best to adjust the color properly. Now, if you're taking a picture in the infrared, where the eye can't see at all, then it's completely false color, and you do the best you can with color coding according to wavelength. The evidence for the Big Bang and for the ancient Earth is utterly overwhelming, and both from a geological point of view, from a biological point of view, from an astronomical point of view, the Earth is of the order, and from an astronomical point of view, the Earth is and planets in the solar system in the universe. Earth is about 4.6 billion years old, and the universe seems to come in at around 13.7, and it's not just one line of evidence. You talk about the Big Bang being, you hear this a lot, just a theory. Well, that the Earth is a sphere is, quote, just a theory, too. It's a model for what you see. And there is no alternative at this point. There's no viable alternative to what we think of as the structure of the universe as being an expanding universe created out of some kind of rapid expansion 13 to 14 billion years old. There's no viable alternative to it unless you push the envelope and say, well, it's all... it's all false and just put together that way. And you might as well say the Earth is flat, and all the evidence that lead to a spherical Earth is all wrong.
But is funding being affected? I mean, here we have somebody
not
who's
particularly
running for a president and who belongs to the Mormon faith, which even has a different version of Earth history. During the time that humans were around.
I think it's being affected more politically by the rush to go to Mars, which seems to me, that's a personal point of view, to be wrongheaded, at least at this point, since we're not even back to the moon yet. And the NASA funding for fundamental sciences and space programs has been more affected by that, I think, than anything else.
Thank you.
And that's a personal point of view.
Yeah. No, I think there are a lot of people who would agree with you. Bye.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let me see. Other calls are possible. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I've been working here trying to get information on the sightings for the shuttle, and there is this. I'm looking at a particular NASA site, and what they do is they ask you what state you're in and what city you're in, and here it lists possible sightings between June 22nd and July 4th, and there were only two, and we've missed them. But and it said only days with sighting opportunities are listed. So that means that between now and next Wednesday, apparently there aren't any.
You got to hit it at the right time.
You
got to hit it at the right time, and it zips around really fast. I mean, the thing goes around in an hour and a half or so. It's quite remarkable the speeds that these things move in Earth orbit.
So
to maintain themselves in orbit, they've got to go fast. Otherwise, they fall down to the ground.
You could have seen it Friday at 9 p.m. You could have seen it Friday night, I guess, at 9 p.m. our time. You also could have seen it Saturday at 9:20. So it would have been at a reasonable time if you wanted to take the kids out and take a look at it in twilight. Yeah. All right. Real quick here, we'll see if we can get one more on a cell phone here in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, Professor Taylor.
Hi.
I took your class many years ago.
Good.
It's been 15 years, so now I can't remember the exact answer to this question, which I know you taught in your class. We were talking about the solstices and the equinoxes, and someone at work was saying that they're always on the same day every year, and I know that's not the case. It sort of varies a little bit, but I couldn't remember the exact explanation as to why.
Oh, that's just leap year effect, that's all. Earth doesn't have an even number of days in a year. It's 365.24 and many, many decimal points. So the date of the equinox and the solstices gradually creep a little bit, and then when leap year comes along, they snap back to a different position. That's the only effect. Over longer periods of time, then you've got the precession of the Earth's axis to deal with, and that will slowly change the date of the equinoxes and the solstices, but that's only over periods of centuries or so.
And that's the wobble, right?
Yeah. That's why the vernal equinox, to an astrologer, the vernal equinoxes and the sign of Aries, and 2,500 years ago, the vernal equinox was in the direction of the constellation Aries. Now it's in the direction of the constellation Pisces, and it takes 26,000 years to go all the way around. So, and that, given an attempt to make a stable calendar that's divorced from that, then that changes the positions of the equinox. This is the cause of the change from the old Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, when we messed around a little bit with the number of leap years over long periods of time to synchronize the calendar with the equinoxes.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Loved your class. I took it many years ago.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the call. We're going to have to end it there with our thanks to our guest, Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy at the U of I. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here.